Session number 10693, reel 11.
Colonel Norman, reel 11. You were telling me about the first period that the battalion spent in the line in Korea.
Yes. I think that the worst thing about it, really, was the weather. That in the hot weather, you get these terrible rainstorms. And all these places where we lived, huts sort of dug into the mountainside. And with all the heavy rain, they just sort of disintegrated and fell down the slope. Very disagreeable it was. Always having to wear wet clothes because there were no facilities for drying at all. And the humidity, even when it wasn't raining, was absolutely terrific.
Did you suffer a lot of sickness as a result of these conditions?
No, I don't think we did. We were remarkably fit. It's quite surprising, really, but I can't recollect any important illnesses that anybody ever had there. Occasionally, one got cramp, and we had salt tablets. Beastly things they were too, and some people couldn't take them. So I couldn't take them sometimes. They would make me frightful. The nausea they'd give you. And I can remember in the winter, when we all had the most marvelous sleeping bags, that I couldn't use them because I used to get cramped, and I couldn't get out of the darn thing to ease myself. So I had to do without it. We had marvellous kit, of course, especially our winter kit, but we thought that was super. Very heavy it was. Not marching in our winter kit wasn't much fun, but it certainly kept us warm. And when you got back after the winter was over into the sort of summer uniform, one's old army ammunition boots were like dancing pumps.
Were there any particular precautions you had to take for hygienic purposes?
Yes, I believe there was some pill we had to take every day, and I suppose mosquitoes. Do you know, I can't remember. But considering the rations we had, I think we did pretty well in the way of health. The army rations weren't very good. We used to get American rations on occasions. When there was a battalion move, you fed on American sea rations, I think they called themselves, for 2 or 3 days. And we thought the first time we had them, absolutely marvellous they were. I think even there was a cigarette ration. But we very soon got sick of the sea rations. And a lot of the time, too, we did have ordinary American rations. I know we all got absolutely sick to death of turkey. Turkey was one of the staple things that you had all the time, and it didn't ever taste of anything much.
So that made you long for good old British bully, did it?
Well, almost anything, really. I can remember once when we were in reserve, the Indian field ambulance asked us to a curry lunch, and that was terrific, except the CO rarely insisted on us all drinking so much gin beforehand, himself just as much as anybody else, that by the time we got to the curry, it wasn't anything like as hot as it should have been. But they did, he sent his cooks to our mess also once when we were in reserve, and they cooked curry lunch for us, and they wouldn't allow anybody else into the kitchen to see how it was being done. It was very good. No, the food was not very remarkable in Korea. Very boring, in fact.
What was the character of the positions you were occupying? Was there a continuous line of entrenchment, or did it consist of two or three-man rifle pits and machine gun positions?
It was more the latter, I think. Really, there was a communication trench all the way around the forward edge of the hill, with pits dug into the forward area, And then round the back of it were the sort of rest and sleeping quarters of the hill. It's very difficult to describe. Ours are always beautifully constructed. Our chaps are so good at that sort of thing. But I do say, of course, when it's wet, it's not funny.
Could you actually see the enemy positions from your own?
No, not really. I mean, they were within sight, but you couldn't see them, if you get what I mean. They were so carefully concealed. And no one ever moved in daylight, if they could possibly help it. I believe their defences were absolutely terrific, but I wouldn't have liked to have been in them much. And, of course, the poor devils, they got strafed with napalm a lot. But the Americans were rather keen on napalm from the air. I didn't think much of their bombing. We had fleet air arm. Occasionally did raids on the enemy positions. They were, we thought, rather more efficient.
Did the Chinese make any major attacks upon you while you were in the line there?
No, not on us. No, they did the same sort of thing as we were trying to do, offensive patrolling, and catching our patrols. It was everybody, they and we got very skillful at this job, and plotting the minefields, and of course all the minefield gaps were known by the gunners. And you could do, I don't know if I mentioned this before, but you could produce the whole of the divisional artillery. One patrol commander could bring the whole divisional artillery down onto a minefield gap or anywhere else if he wanted to, if he thought there was something there. It was called a divisional stonk. And there was, unfortunately, rather a lot of competition among the divisional gunners as to who should get his stonk down before the others. And we rather suspected that the Canadians were rather too keen on that exercise, and they weren't all that accurate in where they produced their stonks. Canadians, extraordinarily enough, weren't all that popular among the divisional, the Commonwealth Division. Commonwealth Division was a remarkable business. It was commanded by an Englishman. In our case, it was, well, when I first got there, advance party was commanded by General Castles, who later became CIGS. But he was succeeded by General Mike Alston Roberts West. I may have left out some of his surnames, but that's what he was known as, Mike West, from the Ox and Bucks. And he had a remarkable effect on everybody. And he was immensely popular, very efficient, knew his stuff, absolutely. I think he had never been to Staff College. I may be wrong there. But he was exceedingly friendly. He insisted that everybody should salute him, whatever they were doing. And he said, this is a form of greeting, and I want to be greeted by you chaps. And whatever you were doing, if you were out shooting pheasants or something, and you suddenly saw the general passing a mile away in his jeep, you stopped and saluted. Or sitting in a jeep, you saluted him as you went past. Well, he commanded three brigades. There was a Canadian brigade, an English brigade, or British brigade, and a Commonwealth brigade. And we were in the Commonwealth brigade. And we had two Australian battalions, 1st and 3rd Royal Australian Regiment, and two British, ourselves and the King's. King's Regiment we had known many years all over the place. They were in Berlin at the same time as us. And when I first rejoined in 1949 or 48, they were in Iserlohn, quite near us, same brigade. And we had New Zealand gunners, field regiment, and an Indian field ambulance, so we couldn't have been more mixed. And we had an Australian brigadier with his Australian brigade major, British DA and QMG, and sort of mixed staff throughout. We were a jolly good brigade, and in fact it's certainly the best formation I've ever served in. I think everybody knew everybody, but the Canadians weren't liked by the Australians. most extraordinary thing. The Australians and New Zealanders always pretended to hate each other, and they're always pulling each other's legs and saying frightful things about each other. But if in reserve, I can remember we gave a drinks party in the mess, and the Canadians were at one end of the room and the Australians at the other, and they just did not mix, and we had to do the whatever mixing there was.
Why do you think that was?
Well, they fancied themselves a bit. I think they were higher paid than anybody else, quite a lot, I believe. They had smarter uniforms and they had their own rations, which I believe were a great deal better than ours.
What did you think of the Australians?
We loved them. We got on very well with them. Our first brigadier later became chief of the general staff in Australia, General Tom Daly. A most awfully nice man, a really good soldier, younger than me, I think, and I was only a major. And he was seen everywhere. He was rather like Monty in that everybody knew him. That's the only thing he was like Monty in, probably. But he would walk on his own round the forward areas, probably with a soldier and a rifle with him, perhaps. But quite informally, he'd drop in and have a chat and with all the chaps, wherever they were, whatever rank. He was succeeded by the man whose name I can't... Willis, I think his name might have been, who was much more the sort of the staff college type, IDC type. In fact, I think he came straight from the IDC to this job, and nothing like as friendly. Tom Daly is still alive, I believe, and very friendly, but very keen on the regiment. When he left, this was when we were in Camp Casey on reserve. I remember I organised quite a large section of the battalion who were doing PT to stop him at a little sort of river crossing in the middle of the camp, and they hauled him out of his jeep and carried him across this creek. He was a very popular chap. I seem to have diverted a good deal.
I was going to ask you a bit more about what went on in the line. You were saying that nothing much happened in daytime, that it all went on at night.
Yes.
Presumably the main activity was night patrolling.
Yes, and sometimes a larger force would go out and try and do a trapping business.
To ambush an enemy patrol.
Yes, we lost a company commander on that.
Did you ever manage to capture any prisoners?
One. The whole time we were there, we captured one man.
Was he Chinese or North Korean?
He was Chinese, as far as I can remember. But it was an extraordinary business. In fact, I wrote a thing about it in a regimental journal or somewhere. And it so happened that he was captured fairly early in the evening, and Patrick O'Donovan, who was then a reporter on The Observer, ex-Irish guardsman who I happened to have known before, he was dining in our mess with us, and we heard that there was a prisoner of war in the MI room. And so I took him along, and he wrote an article about it in The Observer. This chap was obviously seriously ill, and the MO was there giving him transfusions and so on.
Had he been wounded then?
Oh, yes, he'd been wounded. And he just said he was going to die. We'd got on to... It's a great thing from the Corps point of view, was get a prisoner so we can interrogate him all the rest of it. And so we got on to Corps headquarters and told them we got a prisoner. And they actually sent a helicopter for him, which is very unusual to fly a helicopter at night. And the helicopter took him away. And he did die. But he received every possible form of medical help he possibly could have. And the soldiers were so good and gentle with him. But he wasn't going to tell anybody anything, and he died. Not with us. He died after he got into hospital.
Apart from having been wounded, what was his general physical condition?
Good, I thought. He was a typical sort of North Chinaman of some stature, you know. They were quite big chaps compared to the little ones down in the Hong Kong area. Stalwart bloke, I would have said. He might have been a North Korean. I wouldn't know.
Did any of your men get captured by the enemy?
Yes, one, as far as I can remember. I think he was killed. We had three majors who were either killed or died of wounds afterwards. There was one who got a mortar shell on him very soon after we arrived. He lived for some years afterwards, actually, but he was very badly cut up. And I'm sure that when he did die, that was after he commanded 6th Battalion, I'm sure when he did die, it was because of that. We had one who was killed in the minefield, and one, Johnny Tresorno, the DCLI, who was killed on one of these patrol actions.
If you sent out a larger force to try to ambush an enemy patrol, how big would it be?
Jolly nearly company size, I think.
So it's a big
didn't happen
patrol.
Very often. Hmm?
So it was a big fighting patrol?
Yes, yes. Didn't do it very often.
How big was the area of no man's land? How wide?
Oh, it varied enormously. I should think up to a half a mile, perhaps, at the widest. There was one, the most important one of the lot, and I can't remember how wide it was, but there was a point, the highest point in the whole of the divisional area was point 355. It was famous. On the top of it when I first saw it, maybe afterwards, there was a pole with an Aussie hat on it, because they'd occupied this place, and it was very high, and it had a wonderful view all round. And if you lost that, by gum, you were in trouble. We never did. And then there was a gap forward, and there were three hills, and they were called Matthew, Mark, Luke and John. John was the smallest, and there the gap, I think, was narrowest, and it was very, very important one should maintain that. The top of that mountain, well, it's not really a mountain. I can remember it had quite a tricky road up as far as you could go. I remember seeing a jeep go over the side once. Luckily, no one was hurt, but it was a nasty sight.
Did the Chinese attempt similar large-scale fighting patrols against your...
I don't think they did against us, but I'm pretty sure they did against the Americans. They used to broadcast occasionally, you know, too. I can't remember any of the details of it. There was a certain amount of propaganda went on. They seemed to know who we were, too, somehow.
Roughly, how many patrols would go out during a night?
Oh, I think no more than three, probably.
So that would be one per rifle company?
Yes.
How many men would there be in a normal...
About a dozen, I should say.
And what sort of tasks would they be given?
Well, locating minefields, locating the routes of enemy routes which they're likely to take. An intelligence officer was, of course, in charge of all these things. If it wasn't for the CO himself, he didn't go out himself, but nor did the IO, I don't think. Oh, he might have done. But they coordinated the whole business. They sort of O group every morning. Some battalions had a chap called a battle adjutant. We never did. We thought an adjutant's job was the same as it ought to be, just as a CO staff officer. But they had a battle adjutant who really sort of did all the tactical things for the whole battalion. I think the Kings had one. But we didn't approve of that.
Did you ever come under Chinese artillery fire?
Oh yes, we had casualties too, even at battalion headquarters.
What was it like? Was it accurate and effective?
Not all the time. Sometimes it was. I can only remember one really tricky attack on battalion headquarters where I was, and that was quite successful, but whether it was a fluke or not, I simply don't know.
What happened then? Was it just a few rounds coming out of the blue?
Yes, it was. In fact, I was having a bath in my hoochie at the time on that particular occasion. I was rather surprised when a private soldier came in and insisted on getting under shelter. There wasn't any shelter at all. Not really. Rather like the cave in the desert.
And you mentioned that you lost a company commander to Morta.
Yes, Sean Kelly.
Did they do a lot of mortaring?
Yes, quite a bit.
What would you normally do if they did start up mortaring? Did you get artillery?
Yes.
Support to get
yes.
back up
they're
there?
Very quick at it too, and with the air spotter business too, that helped a lot. the morale of the battalion, I think I ought to mention, was very, very high indeed. Peter Jeffries was an absolute first-class CO, and everybody had the most enormous confidence in him and everything he decided to do, and it sort of seeped all the way down. We had jolly good county commanders, and really the battalion was terrific. And we had, it wasn't, see, all DLI chaps either. I had a DLI batman and a DCLI driver. They got on terribly well with each other. And really, there was no anybody. You never thought that they came from miles apart from their native origins. It was a very good battalion indeed. And you never knew any difference between the regulars and the non-regulars. We had a very high-class MO who had a pretty tragic time after the war over, but a really high-class bloke.
You mentioned regulars and non-regulars. Roughly what proportion of the battalion were regular soldiers?
I think it's an absolute guess. About a quarter, I should think.
Had there been any effort to select national servicemen to go to Korea?
Not particularly. I don't think there had been. At about the same time, or very soon after we went to Korea, our second battalion was raised again, and under Mark Leather, who had been our second in command. And they had a hell of a time, really, because we were going on active service, and Peter Jeffries had the first choice of the people he wanted, or Michael Hammer for him. So Mark was left, really, as one almost might say, with a sort of second choices all the way along. In fact, it only lasted 2 or 3 years and was then abolished again. But they did terribly well, and one of the things they did was to win the Army Football Cup in Germany. No, I don't think there was any selection between national service and regulars. We had enough chaps of experienced soldiers to run a battalion, whether they were national service or not. And we had a lot of national service officers, one of whom is now GOC in Southeastern District, Lieutenant General Sir Peter de la Billière, KCB, DSO, and MC, I think, as well. He joined us in Korea. The present Colonel, Deputy Colonel, Light Infantry Durham, joined us just before Korea, Brigadier McGregor Oakford. Both done terribly well ever since. And I'll give you an example of the sort of state of the battalion's morale. On Coronation Day, one got up in the morning, and I think there was a bugle salute or something like that, and the gunners did some pretty colours in the sky with smoke. And immediately opposite our positions, on the forward area of the Chinese position, in fluorescent panels, was an E2R and a crown on top, which had been put out in the night by some of our officers, one of whom I believe was General de la Billière. And oddly enough, that thing stayed there until we'd left the position at the end of the war. Extraordinary thing.
The Chinese didn't disturb it.
Possibly didn't know it was there. this is a sort of happy atmosphere that existed in the battalion all the time. And of course, when we were in reserve, or even when we were in the line, we used to have loud pheasant shooting. We had some regimental shotguns with us, and the pheasant shooting in Korea was absolutely superb, because no one had shot at them for years, except the Americans with helicopters and machine guns. Of course, they didn't do it any much good. But life wasn't all that unpleasant, and we really rather enjoyed the cold weather, as long as you kept properly dressed, and you didn't stand facing the north wind for more than 60 seconds or so at a time, because if you did, your nose possibly would have fallen off. But you felt awfully fit.
How long were you in Korea? Was it for a full year?
Me personally, it was just about a full year, yes. I left again to take over command of the 6th Battalion in England. And I sailed with the battalion advance party who were going to Egypt. And they stopped at Geneva or Fayed, I can't remember which. They got off at Portside. And I went sailing on.
And while you were in Korea, was there a regular routine of alternating being in the line with being back in reserve?
No, once we got there, we stayed there. The company positions were there, and we stayed there, as far as I can remember, until we pushed into reserve, the whole battalion.
But how long would you stay in the line before going back into reserve?
All the time. We only once went into the reserve, as far as I can remember, until the war ended. Wait a minute. No, I'm wrong there. We had this period at Camp Casey, and then towards the end of the war, we were put into reserve, and that was the time when I had to reconnoitre these positions, because the CO was on leave. He only had one leave. Well, I only had one leave too. I had to reconnoitre these positions, backing up the brigade. That's it. And there was great consternation because constant attacks on the Hook, which is on the extreme left of our position, and the Chinese were determined to capture the Hook, which was a very vulnerable area and could have caused us terrible trouble. And the American Marines who were holding the Hook were not doing at all well. Everybody knew the war was going to end pretty soon, and morale there was, well, I'm down if I'm going to risk myself for another 3 days or something or other. That was the impression one got. And I remember Peter Jeffries, under actually his own initiative, moved the battalion up to position just behind the Hook in case he'd have to take over or reinforce. Therefore we were in reserve there. And then the war finished, and I think that's where we stayed.
Were you there when the war finished?
Yes. Yes, I was. I went up to Panmunjom. I looked at Panmunjom when I was attached to the visiting the American, whatever corps it was on our left.
How much warning did you have that the war was likely to come to an end?
Oh, it was expected, really, from day to day, for about a month, I suppose.
Did you notice any change in the Chinese activity in that last
Not that month? I can remember. I don't think I told you about